Thank you. Good morning. Good morning, snowbirds. Good morning, snowflakes. Good morning, comrades and citizens of the global world in which we live. I read from a headline in the New York Times of October 5th of this year. Labor, revitalized with new recruiting, has regained power and prestige. It's from the New York Times about 2 months ago. Yet I remind you, if reminding is needed, that less than 15% of the labor force is organized in unions right now. This is down from a high of about 40% in the early 1950s. That the unionized, the classic unionized sectors of the American economy, industrial workers, that sector of the economy continues to lose jobs. That labor's political clout, at least until this week perhaps, appears to be questionable, with the North American Free Trade Agreement being Exhibit A, that is the willingness of the Clinton administration, the Democratic Party, to sign on to that, although this week, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, with the World Trade Organization protests suggests a different development. Corporations seem to have incredible leeway when it comes to fending off unionization, fending off unionization or organizing drives, both through their ability to dodge domestic labor law and through the possibility of shifting production overseas in this global economy. So despite the New York Times optimism, there also may be reasons for pessimism in terms of the possibility of organized labor being revitalized in new millennium. Now, I come to you today not really so much as a commentator on current events, although I'll talk about that, but as a historian. Now, what I know about current trends in the labor movement is really what most of you, just about anyone, could pick up from the press or from the internet. What I can tell you about the future of the organized labor movement, of course, is as good as anyone else's guess. But what I do think I can do, or what I hope to do today, is to suggest how some historic patterns in American history may suggest whether this is indeed a time for optimism in terms of trade union affairs, or for pessimism in terms of the future of organized labor. I do this with some trepidation because while I'm a historian and I can talk with confidence about the past, many of the people in this room have lived the very past that I presume to talk about, and so I'm sure that some of your questions at the end will be to that point as I talk about the history of organized labor in the United States, try and connect it to some of the current trends. I'm sure that some of you will speak to me afterwards about what it was like to be part of that history, and you can correct me or emphasize points that I may miss with that in mind. Now, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., the American historian, the liberal historian that many radicals and progressives love to hate, said one very sensible thing. And that's that American history has moved in cycles. And by this he meant that moments of progressive reform, mostly state action to protect the weak, tend to come in 30-year cycles. Although these cycles usually depend on state government action reform, they often were accompanied by mass mobilization from the grassroots. And Schlesinger here, I think, is thinking of periods like the Progressive Era, the first decade of the 20th century, and the passage of things like the Pure Food and Drug Act and health and safety laws in the workplace for the first time. And of course, the next cycle would be the 1930s and Roosevelt's New Deal and the legislation of that period, much of which we know is still very essential to people's livelihoods today, Social Security in particular. And the third cycle perhaps might be the liberalism associated with John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Baines Johnson in the 1960s. The civil rights movement, the Great Society reforms, Medicare, Medicaid, and so forth, another great era of reform in 20th century American history, although, as we know, marred, deeply flawed by the Vietnam War. What about the 1990s, which would be the next logical cycle in these 30-year progressions? I think perhaps the 1990s have been rather disappointing in this regard. But again, when one looks at the possibilities for organized labor, perhaps I'll suggest today there's a glimmer of hope underneath the surface. Now, the timing and chronology for labor's participation in these reform efforts may not fit the model exactly, and yet I think in the case of the history of labor as well, its fortunes have gone through similar cycles of decline and renewal or revitalization over the past century. And those are the cycles that I'll try and point to today. First, the 1890s, the great strikes and labor conflicts of that era, and then the consolidation of really the first organized trade union movement in the country, the American Federation of Labor, in the wake of the great class conflicts of the 1890s. Secondly, of course, the 1930s, not just an era associated with New Deal reform emanating from Congress and Roosevelt and the Democratic Party, but for labor historians like myself, an era associated with mass mobilization of hundreds of thousands of mass production workers all across the country who took to the streets and the shop floors of their workplaces and demanded protection of their rights, fair wages, and the sort of rights that workers globally are demanding today in the face of something like the World Trade Organization. That's how I'll end up there. But so the 1930s being the next cycle, the creation of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, which I suspect several people in this room were affiliated with at one time, the growth of industrial unionism, and of course what was called labor's Magna Carta, the Wagner Act of 1935, which I'm sure most of you know, still weakly perhaps, but still governs labor management relations in this country today. So, in the light of those cycles, is the 1990s a third moment of revitalization and renewal akin to the 1890s and the 1930s for organized labor? That's the question I'm going to address today. What have been the crucial elements? This is what I sort of asked myself as I started thinking about labor in the 90s. What have been the crucial elements of labor's revitalization and renewal in the past, historically? And how present might those elements be in today's labor movement? That was sort of the task I set for myself as I thought about what I would say today. So let me list several key factors for labor's renewal historically, not all of which have been present at each moment, but I think which are important. One would be what some people have called second channels for the labor movement. That is, links to other social movements present at the time, which have allowed organized labor and workers more generally to express their interests, not just in terms of better wages or conditions for them on their particular shop floor in their particular workplace, but to connect to larger social movements for change at a particular time and place. That might be today, the environmental movement, historically and perhaps today, student organizers. Of course, I think central to this conception of second channels or other outlets for organized labor social concerns would be civil rights, historically the 30s and the 40s, interracial organizing, or you might think of the 1960s, and La Causa of the United Farm Workers and Cesar Chavez. So links to these other social movements or to the church as well would be another place to look, have been important, I think, historically at labor's moments of renewal. Secondly, related, I think, is a connection to explicitly left-wing political organizations at different times and places. This may or may not mean organized electoral politics, but it certainly has meant in the 1890s, the 1930s, and perhaps today, with forging a link with left-wing political organizations has created within the labor movement a cadre of committed activists who have pushed that movement forward. I think historically one can make that case. I'll give you some specific examples in a few moments. Thirdly, very important, particularly I'll wrap up with this because I think it's on everyone's minds this week, the question of internationalism. What has labor's relationship, domestic labor organizations' relationship been to world affairs, international flows of capital or people, questions of trade? These issues have been central at moments of labor's renewal, and the choices that the labor movement has made and that organized workers have made about their connection to the larger world beyond the borders of the United States has been crucial, I think, to the progress of organized labor in this country. And historically, I would think those choices have often been made badly, and perhaps the 1990s suggest that that may be different, or at least the signs are pointing in the right direction over the past few weeks, certainly, I think. Fourthly, Pretty straightforward. What organizational form is appropriate to the power and structure of capital at any particular moment? On what basis do organized workers come together? On their skills, on their crafts, on their workplace, on their industry, or on some other association which makes more sense depending on the climate of the economy? This has been a central question the labor movement has asked itself at each moment that it was expanding. And again, when the answer to that question, how do you organize workers, on what basis do you organize workers, has been crucial to either the success or failure of the organized labor movement at particular historical junctures. Fifth, very related to that last question, I think, what power and possibility is there in organizing those people who are unorganized, those people who are on the fringes or completely marginalized to the core of organized labor as it exists at a particular moment? Will the labor movement reach out to them and incorporate them into a trade union movement, or will it rather take a more exclusive approach and try and distance itself from people on the outside? This might be nationally or internationally. And that decision to be inclusive or exclusive has been crucial in labor's history and is today as well, I think. Now, this is a bundle of criteria that, as we shall see, are all closely related and I think do all have a bearing on the present situation. So let's measure some past periods of labor's revitalization by these criteria. What about a century ago, in the 1890s and the turn of the century? A period marked by great labor turmoil and open class conflict. I tell my students this all the time, it's hard for them to grasp it, that in the 1890s, there was class conflict in this country, and people talked about it in those terms without any doubt or shame. Perhaps some anxiety, perhaps some pride in the case of working class people, but it was very clear that the organized forces of capital and the organized forces of labor were at odds, and a great deal of violent social conflict ensued because of this. And people get all exercised about some anarchists smashing the windows of Nike and Starbucks last week. You go back to the Pullman strike of 1894, or the Homestead strike of 1892, where the steel workers armed themselves physically with rifles and shoot the Pinkerton spies who are trying to break their strike. Or another one I've looked at closely is the coal miners of Tennessee go on strike to protest the presence of convict workers in the coal mines of Tennessee in 1891 and 1892. They don't just picket, they take up guns, remove the convicts from the mines, ship them back to the state capital, and when the state militia shows up to try and reopen the mines, they're fended off by physical confrontation with armed violence. I'm not saying this was a good thing, a bad thing, but the point is that American labor history is not a peaceful, smooth accommodation between labor and capital. And of course, most of you know, the examples I've given may suggest that workers engaged in violence to defend their interests, but the vast majority of violence was carried out against workers by the forces of the state, right down to the Memorial Day massacre of 1937, during the great steelworkers organizing drive of the late 1930s, where dozens of workers were shot in the back by the Chicago police as they were peacefully trying to organize a Republic steel mill in South Chicago. So there's a long history of violent social conflict in American history. And the 1890s, I think, being a place where it really came to a head. Now, in that period, what sort of links in the 1890s, what sort of links with other movements was the labor movement able to forge? Certainly there were connections in that early period of labor history with intellectuals, writers, artists, academics, perhaps the most renowned one being that with Upton Sinclair, who wrote the great novel, The Jungle, describing the conditions in the meatpacking plants of Chicago in which Lithuanian, Polish, German, and other immigrants labored. Now, again, you may be familiar with this. One of the great ironies about Sinclair, he wrote the Jungle, I believe, in 1906, early part of the century, 1904. He wrote this to exhort workers in the packing houses and across the country to join the Socialist Party, to become socialists, to defend themselves against rapaciousness of capital by engaging in socialist politics. The Jungle's great effect, however, was to encourage Teddy Roosevelt to pass the Food and Drug Act of 1906. As Sinclair said, "I aimed at the public's heart, but I hit it in the stomach." Right? And this is a great moment in American history. And I think, again, this is something I emphasize to my students, that there was this link forged between someone like Sinclair and the organized labor movement, but the consequences of it weren't exactly what he planned. But nevertheless, I think this suggests this is a period in which people like Sinclair, or people, religious activists, the social gospel, this 1890s, turn of the century, is a great era of preachers getting up and speaking in favor of the rights of organized labor. I think you see that today, as I'll mention at the end. Or connections with the women's movement, very important. The struggle for suffrage, the women's right to vote, that took place in the first two decades of this century, had close links with the attempt to organize women workers in a place like the garment sweatshops of the Lower East Side of New York. And so I think that sort of social ferment of which labor was a part was very significant in that era. Or, if not connections with civil rights organizations, ethnic associations were central to the construction of the early labor movement. The United Hebrew Trades, for instance, being a very important example of that, right? But in the end, in the 1890s, these sort of alternative associations that labor was able to forge proved rather peripheral, unfortunately, I think, to the main concerns of the American Federation of Labor, the AFL, which in the end became a set of craft unions bent on protecting their own specific and rather narrow interests. That sort of was the outcome of that period. What about the left in this period? Here I think the key formation was the Socialist Party of Eugene Debs, which grew out of the Pullman strike of 1894, the failures of the populist movement of the 1890s, and the growing municipal reform movements. These three things sort of came together to create the Socialist Party, which was an important second channel for organized labor, which had an important presence even within the American Federation of Labor and certain trade unions, such as the United Mine Workers of America. But in the end, was marginalized, partly because it was crushed during World War I, partly because the American Federation of Labor always managed to distance itself from the Socialist Party in the end, despite a large number of socialists in that trade union federation at the top. Someone like Samuel Gompers was not a socialist by the 19-teens. And so the AFL craft unions ultimately were able to outflank the sort of political movement that Debsian socialism represented, and yet again a suggestion that the connection between organized labor and the organized left was significant in that period. What about the unorganized? Yes, at first, the early labor movement of the 1890s, particularly as represented by the Socialist Party and the industrial workers of the world, did reach out to the man in the gutter, as Big Bill Haywood of the IWW would suggest. But in the end, the American Federation of Labor ended up going the way of exclusivity, of representing the interests of skilled craftsmen, of male workers, of whites, and often of non-immigrant workers as well. And in the end of this period of renewal, the mandate of organizing the unorganized, I think, ultimately fell flat, unfortunately. This is related to the organizational form that labor took in this early period a century ago, which was resolutely, with the exception of the United Mine Workers, and sometimes with the garment trades in New York City, a craft unionism, an exclusive club of those people who were able to maintain their skills even in the face of mass production, scientific management, and increased managerial control. So that by the 1920s, after all of this conflict, after all of this upsurge, after the Socialist Party successes, nevertheless, by the 1920s, only 6% of the American workforce is organized. And this vast majority of these people are in skilled craft unions, are white, are male, and the immigrant presence as well wasn't as significant as it probably should have been, since the masses of American workers were indeed immigrants in this period. Which brings me to the fifth question: what about the internationalism of the labor movement a century ago? Quite weak, frankly, especially on the question of immigration. The AFL was faced with a choice after 1900. Should they encourage and incorporate the immigrant working class into these skilled craft unions? A few unions went that direction. There was some reaching out. But I think in general, the American Federation of Labor, in the end, got onto the bandwagon that suggested that the American worker must protect his standards and conditions by excluding the undercutting of American wages by immigrant labor. That was sort of an internationalist position, which at least a powerful wing of the American Federation of Labor took at that period, a rather xenophobic position. Again, I'm suggesting this because you'll see when you talk about the same questions in the 90s, will labor take a protectionist and xenophobic internationalist stand, or will it reach out to workers across the globe, is in many ways the question on the agenda that the WTO conflict this week has highlighted. So I'll return to that. So that internationalist question is answered badly, I think, in the early decades of the labor movement. Now, so by the end of the 1920s, on the eve of the Depression, you have a profoundly weak labor movement, a limited vision dominated by corporate capital and company unionism, not particularly connected to other social movements. Perhaps in 1929, organized labor looked quite a bit like it might have looked in 1989, after 9 years of Ronald Reagan. But as I'm sure most of you know, indeed some of you may have cut your political teeth in the subsequent movement, the 1930s and 1940s saw the birth of the modern labor movement. And in the early Congress of Industrial Organizations, created in 1936 by John L. Lewis, a new kind of social unionism, which many people in the labor movement, thankfully, would like to reclaim today.